What we're gonna do right here is go back, way back, back into time.
Now here's what I want you all to do for me.
Bang! Caught you looking for the same thing. It's a new thing. Check out this. I bring all the roll below the level.
Let's do this. What is virtualization?
You're gonna learn today.
Innovate like a startup. Deliver like an enterprise.
I hope you're coffeeed up and ready because it's gonna be a great day.
I know you're gonna dig this.
Oh, yeah.
You're listening to the Virtually Speaking Podcast with Pedro Aero and John Nicholson.
Good afternoon and welcome to the Virtually Speaking Podcast, episode number 165. My name is Pete Fletcher, a.k.a. Pedro Aero, and joining me once again is Mr. John Nicholson. John, how you doing, my man?
I'm buried in paperwork, Pete.
Paperwork.
I'm just signing papers. I'm refinancing my mortgage right now. Interest rates are low. But by the way, did we not tell everyone this is now a finance podcast? So
I wasn't aware of that. Are we doing a separate podcast on financing? Okay.
Now, let's, much like as I'm trying to sort through those papers, I think it's time we just get back to the basics a bit on storage.
Yeah.
Let's go back to our roots. Let's get back. You know, I grew up in boots. Let's get back.
Ah, there it is, the cheesy segue. Yeah, John, that's right. We're going to go back to basics. This is something that we've done in the past. For those of you that are new to the podcast, you can check out some of the other episodes. We do these back to basic episodes. Let's see, we've done one on vSphere networking, vSphere core services. And this week we're going to dedicate a back to basics episode to iSCSI. Yeah, iSCSI is definitely a storage protocol that many folks are familiar with, but we want to get back to the basics. We want to understand the fundamentals of iSCSI, maybe common mistakes, best practices, and we're not going to talk about it alone. We brought on some of the experts. And so contributing to this conversation from one of VMware's valued storage partners, Pure Storage, are a few good friends of mine. First off, J-Hop Hopkinsons. J-Hop, welcome to the podcast.
Hey, thanks for having me, Pete. It's good to be here.
Yeah, for those of you that don't know J-Hop, he's a solutions architect at Pure Storage. He's on Twitter at @pure_J-Hop, and he's quite the iSCSI expert. And joining J-Hop, also from Pure Storage, and certainly no stranger to the podcast, our good friend, Mr. Cody Hosterman. Cody, welcome back.
Hey, thanks for inviting me back on. It's I was just talking to Jason yesterday, and I don't know what happened, but all of a sudden I saw this Slack message. Hey, we should talk about iSCSI. And I'm like, I'm talking about iSCSI right now with Jason. So, you know, one at a time, my friend, but it's good to be here.
Yeah. Cody's definitely no stranger to having conversations around iSCSI. And yes, you mentioned you were talking to Jason Massey. So yeah, we can't have an iSCSI podcast without Jason. Jason, welcome back to the podcast.
Thanks. Glad to be on. Yeah, this is definitely one of the more popular subjects that comes around. Seems that all my vMUG sessions keep getting picked as iSCSI instead of eVols or core storage best practices. It's kind of interesting that iSCSI keeps coming up, like you said.
Oh, yeah. And so this is a back to basics episode. So why don't we start super high level, and then with this group, I'm sure we'll be diving into the weeds within about 10 seconds. But Jason, why don't you give us the 50,000 foot view? Why are there different protocols? Why do we need iSCSI?
So one of the nice things about iSCSI is that when there's customers that are looking at block storage, right? And maybe they don't want to invest into a full FC environment, they can do a converged network and add their storage across their Ethernet network. And so it makes it pretty simple. And then the other thing that we're starting to see is that as we're migrating towards these higher speed Ethernet NICs, right, we've got 25, 40, even 100, the need for a separate network really isn't there anymore. Right? Having a whole separate storage infrastructure when you've got 100 gig Ethernet, you've got plenty of bandwidth to use that block storage across with everything else.
Sure. That's fair.
Okay. I mean, are you guys seeing the same thing, Cody? I mean, when J-Hop, you guys, I mean, isn't that kind of what you're seeing too? It's they're looking for the simplification, right? They can still use block storage without having to have a whole nother infrastructure and manage an FC environment.
Yeah, I've seen two patterns on kind of either end of the customer spectrum over the years when it comes to iSCSI. Right? Traditionally, most block customers were leveraging Fibre Channel. For a variety of reasons. And, you know, one of the jokes that Larry Touche, one of the guys who works at Pure, a great guy, always makes around this is that, you know, storage admins see their Fibre Channel network as an array, a cable, and a server, right? They see their Ethernet network as, a server, a rat's nest of cables going who knows where, and then an array somewhere at the other end of it, right? But what we've been seeing from our customers around iSCSI is two different things. One, some of the larger customers, the enterprise level, whatever you want to call them, they've been changing their backend fabrics. They've been building new data centers, and they have these just huge, very, very thick Ethernet, you know, backbone networks, right? And so the throughput is there, way surpassing what they potentially have with their fiber channel network. And so they're going route for a variety of reasons, and a lot of the reasons that Jason mentioned. And then the other side of the spectrum has been a little bit newer around the adoption of iSCSI, is that we have some customers that, because either due to the, you know, simplicity now of being able to manage storage, I think managing storage these days is way easier than it used to be, right? You don't need storage admins these days to, you know, manage a single array and things like that. They don't need to be experts at the least, right? Really around that is my more appropriate way to put it, is that we've had some of the smaller customers too. They're like, hey, we can now afford, as in not as a money, like a dollar thing, but like afford to have someone buy and manage a storage array, right? Because they don't need to be experts on it. It doesn't take more of their time. But these customers didn't have fiber channel networks. They have Ethernet networks, right? Because maybe they use some NAS appliance or something like that. And so what's the best way to plug that in, the block array, into that network? Well, it's iSCSI. And so it's either end of that spectrum where we've seen a significant amount of adoption around iSCSI.
Well, and if we think back to like the earlier days of fiber channel, when, you know, 4 gig was really kind of was ruling the nest, you had at best 1 gig Ethernet, and that 1 gig Ethernet, unless you had deployed some just switches from hell, generally had pretty weak buffers. A lot of people's top rack switches might have been Cisco like 3500s or something, that the buffers were just anemic. And so not only did you have four times less throughput, but you also had the latency and the consistency of throughput and avoiding, you know, other complications versus, you know, fiber channel with its deep buffers and more civilized buffer architecture. There was just massive gaps in performance. But now with affordable 25 and 10 gig Ethernet with decent switches, you know, and fiber channel has evolved, but I mean, so has Ethernet with 100 gig and, you know, 100 gig to on the leaf spine, 50 gig to the host. That gap just seems to have pancaked quite a bit.
Yeah. And, you know, you're talking about just when you're talking about hardware, right? We're also with the software iSCSI adapter now, we're getting near line rate. So you don't even have to buy the special iSCSI NICs anymore. We're not doing dependent and independent. In fact, I don't think, have you guys even seen any recently? Any customers doing that?
Yeah. No, it's, in fact, to a point in our documentation, we actually say that your software iSCSI initiator is going to be often more tested and more reliable than the hardware these days, because they're just, it's used so much more often, things are caught quicker. So it's very rare that we actually see customers these days using hardware iSCSI.
So we actually don't support the iSCSI initiators for connection to the vSAN iSCSI service. They actually did some testing, and we were very unhappy with the testing. It just didn't issue a support statement. So, and just talking to customers, I occasionally, once in a while, Cody and I will see someone on Twitter who's like, I want to do boot from iSCSI using the hardware iSCSI initiator. And I think we both shake our heads and bring back an old tweet storm thread of why this is a stupid idea. But I think we're reaching the point on the hardware iSCSI initiators where it's a feature that, you know, less than 1% of customers use. And if there's anything I've learned from the various ODMs and their firmware, is when you start using a feature that less than 1% of people use, there's no QE. And stuff, there's when regressions hit, like no one cares. So it's just not a good place, I think, to be in, frankly, these days.
Yeah.
And I think another piece of this too is that I think more and more these days, the ability to try a technology is a really important thing, right? And the easier it is to try, the less you have to do to get to that point, like the more adoption it's going to have. And I think, you know, we can go back and forth between FC and iSCSI and so forth, but at least the one thing around iSCSI is that all the configuration is host side, right? There's no zoning, right? I mean, yeah, there might be some switch configuration at some point.
You can do some VLANs, but you're not like doing individual Mac to Mac assignments.
Exactly. It's not 100% required to at least get it working to try. And so that to be able to just add the software iSCSI adapter kind of regardless to your hardware and so forth and start doing it has seen some increased interest around that. And then once they get that, user like, well, we might as well just push this to production and use that choice.
People can test iSCSI at home. Like I have a Synology under my desk. Like it's not hard to set up iSCSI, you know, with that. Doing fiber channels, when was the last time we saw someone with a fiber channel lab at home? I'm sure we're going to have one of our listeners tweeting furiously at me of like, I do, you know, I've still got some some silkworms or something, well, but like...
I do, but that's okay. But I, you know.
Yeah, I would expect the guy who came out of a support org at a fiber channel rearrange shop to maybe have one, but like, yeah.
Well, for the pure guys on the call, what are some of the more common mistakes you see when customers start testing or evaluating iSCSI? What are some of the more common mistakes you see?
I think I'll let J-Hop dig into this one because, you know, J-Hop joined my team about a year ago, but he was in our escalations team for many, many years. He's been up here longer than I have. And so he's seen pretty much everything when it comes to this. So J-Hop, why don't you?
Yeah. The answer is always jumbo frames. First off, I mean, it's, this is also one of those things where there's still, even to this day, so much heated discussion about it. It's quite comical sometimes seeing how people get into this so passionately. But I would definitely say jumbo frames, and especially when it comes specific to VMware, you know, it's important to make sure you have it from the bottom up, right? So that you got to have your virtual switch that has it. You got to have your physical switch. Your storage needs to have it set. You got to be set on the VM kernel adapter. So it can be kind of confusing for people at first. And so I definitely say that's number one, in my opinion.
Well, yeah, when we talk to GSS, so, you know, this is one of the things I bring up. The first thing I talk about when I'm talking about iSCSI in my session is GSS gets a lot of storage calls. And every time I talk to them, it is still number one, port binding or jumbo frames on iSCSI. That is the top of their list continuously for storage problems. It's amazing. I mean, then there's FC and NFS and stuff like that, but consistently it's iSCSI and it's either port binding or jumbo frames.
So what about port binding? How are they doing it wrong?
Usually the case is that they haven't set up the kernels to NIC binding correctly, right? So they're not getting that one-to-one ratio of a kernel to a NIC, and they're making it, usually the biggest error is they're setting the second NIC as a failover NIC, and it's supposed to be unused. So when you do port binding, just as a quick, simple, every kernel is tied to a NIC and is only tied to that NIC. It is not set to fail back, and there is no failover NIC.
No standby. So it's just when you look at that VM kernel port, all you're going to see is one active and everything else unused.
Correct. And that's something that people miss a lot. And then if you don't set that correctly, when you go to bind it on the software iSCSI, right, it fails the health check. And somehow, I don't know how people are getting past that, but they are.
So this is what I see is the biggest problem around port binding. Sorry, you got me excited, Jason. I couldn't help myself. So the biggest problem is kind of, to my opinion, is the same reason that people complain about don't use resource pools as folders. It's like, well, when you first log into the vSphere client, the first thing you see are resource pools. And so people are going to naturally use that because they hate seeing 1,000 VMs in the list. But it's kind of, the problem is that, you know, by default, it kind of works, right? So iSCSI will work, I mean, generally perfectly fine without doing port binding, right? You add your iSCSI target, your software adapter, you add your target, and it works. The problem is that by default, if you don't set up port binding, it uses your IP routing tables to figure out what NIC to use. And often that could be something like your management NIC, which may have a slower network. You know, depending on how you set the back end up, that may not be what you want it to use, but it will work. And that's sometimes the biggest enemy here, is that when they get into a situation that does cause some kind of a problem, there is some kind of outage, there is a workload that needs performance, that's when that problem occurs. Sometimes I wish it just didn't work without port binding.
So I just want to do a PSA here. It shouldn't work, because if your management VM kernel port, it can successfully route to your storage array HBA ports, you have a horrible security configuration. You're bringing back flashbacks to me discovering that a FAS I was configuring, that the 100 meg management port is where all the data was coming out of, because it found the path, and, you know, Unix, you know, bindings would do that. This is even not even a unique VMware problem. You should make sure that your storage VLAN is end-to-end only routed to other storagey things, be that a replication site or normally just the initiators to the targets and nothing else. This is sometimes mistakenly viewed as a performance best practice. I guess you're avoiding broadcast traffic, but this is a security best practice, and it prevents what Cody's talking about here as a secondary benefit.
Right. And yeah, I think definitely dedicating a VLAN, that is one of the best practices, right? If you think of it in the same idea of an FC environment, your FC environment isn't shared with everything. So why would you share your storage iSCSI traffic with everything? It needs to be isolated.
But the challenge there is you've got to work with a networking team who may pretend that VLANs are a non-renewable resource that we need to conserve for future generations.
Exactly.
This is something that, you know, we do have to discuss, but it's this is a fight worth having with your with those networking terrorists and getting those VLANs provisioned for networking.
And I think this goes back to what I said earlier, right? Is there's kind of the two different types of burgeoning iSCSI customers. There's the enterprise level, and then there's then the small, medium business level, where enterprise level has very strict requirements around their network usually, right? Around segregating out traffic and so forth. Well, a lot of these newer iSCSI customers, it's just kind of a fairly flat network and as it works. And that's where we see sometimes that problem coming in a little bit more.
Cody, it sounded like the port binding discussion was like you're on premises there for a minute. It kind of triggered you a little bit.
There's a lot of trigger words. You know, Cody is obviously one of them. V-balls is another one. And port binding is probably
so
high up there.
I think it is important to note, though, there are cases where port binding cannot be used. And so
that's correct.
Like, you know, we got to be careful not to discourage everyone and say, don't, you know, you always have to use port binding. And one of those things is routing, right? A lot of people don't realize that if you're going to route, port binding can actually be a very big enemy. Especially it for can. Discovery times, rescan times, reboot times. So VMware actually has an amazing article that I probably use like 800,000 times a week when someone asks me this question, which is they lay out very clearly, when should you use port binding? When shouldn't you? And I would just advise everyone, please go to that KB, review it, make sure it makes sense for your environment is the big takeaway.
Yeah, I will be leaving that KB on the show notes of this podcast for sure.
Yeah, and the key, right? Port binding is the best practice. Not routing your network is also a good practice, right? The more hops, the more routes you add, you're just inducing latency, and you don't want to have this additional latency that has nothing to do with your storage infrastructure, right? Well, you're now adding these hops, and it's like, okay, well, that's just a tiny bit more latency. That's a route. That's another piece of latency. And so trying to avoid those is definitely one of the things you should try and do.
Well, and to be fair, like modern layer 3 top of rack switches can route at wire speed. The challenge comes is where you get confused about where the gateway is, and suddenly it's not just going through your top of rack, but it's going through like some 2801 ISR that someone forgot in the corner. That is an area where when you start doing a lot of routes, you can, and for instance, if you're doing a stretch clustering, putting a layer 3, you know, route between the sites might make sense to avoid spanning tree problems. But at the same time, just have a lot of awareness of what that router is physically, where it is, and don't be afraid to chase through CAM tables and actually inspect and figure out what that path really looks like, because the physical may not actually align with the logical, particularly if spanning tree isn't working properly.
Yeah, couldn't agree more. And that's one of the discussions I had with a customer just the other day, who's like, I read all this documentation about performance. I'm like, well, it's not necessarily performance. It's, do you know where it's all going? And so I think that's an excellent point for sure. So,
and Jap, you've written a KB on this too. Like, so what's your opinion on port binding versus NIC teaming or something like LICP?
You know, so
yes, do tell.
I hate this conversation. I'm not going to lie, because it's because they're both good, right? NIC teaming has its benefits. Like for instance, if I pull a physical cable and you're NIC teaming, you're never going to even know it's going to blip in a split second, right? The ESX layer isn't going to be any the wiser. So I get it, right? There are good things about NIC teaming, but it has one major downfall in my opinion. And that's that it doesn't have the full information from the PSA. And so you don't get all of the benefits of knowing what's going on with your storage when you're using NIC teaming. And that's the biggest downfall. Do I think that NIC teaming is worth investigating and seeing if it works for your environment? Sure. But if I had to write a best practice, which I did, it would be definitely port binding for insight into what's happening with storage, for getting those SCSI sense codes, knowing when to fail over, everything like that. That is going to be your best bet in my experience in the storage industry.
Well, my understanding is the only time where NIC teaming and iSCSI in theory ever would be a good-ish idea, and I say ish, would be if you were doing multiple connections per server, MCS,
yes,
which I'm not sure vSphere supports. I was only aware of basically one or two vendors ever adopting. It just seems like you're adding a lot of complexity of doing MCS plus a lag and then trying to get a really good hash versus MPIO multiple paths and having a round robin PSP that's latency sensitive and can work around that, which actually maybe that segues into path selection policies. What are our options? Why do some exist? What are, you know, should you trust the default third party custom? What should we look at there?
As a default, right, we work with all of our partners and we try and get a SATP claim rule that sets those PSPs. And so each vendor tries to recommend what PSP they want to use, whether it's, you know, most recently used, round robin, or fixed. Now, in some cases, we have some vendors that actually want us to install a VIB that has a custom PSP and it's not in box. And so there's a little extra step in that. Now, you mentioned the latency, right? We, in 6.7, we released the latency PSP round robin that actually does what they call a working average, looking at the outstanding IO and the latency of each path. And so it can make an intelligent decision and decide which path has a lower working average. And Cody and JAP have done a lot of testing on that, and they saw really good balance across multiple links, even with arrays that are within the same physical location, but just a little bit different in latency. They saw the, you know, maybe you guys can kind of speak to that. But, you know, as far as the PSP goes, again, this is going to be something VMware is going to give you a general best practice, and the partners are going to give you what is recommended for that array.
Yeah, as far as Pure goes, you know, our best practice for a long time has been IOPS equals one, round robin, blah, blah, blah. But, you know, with the introduction of 6.7, we've been testing the latency policy for a while. And with the introduction of 7.0, it's now our default. So there's a claim rule inside of ESX that claims us with a latency policy. And so that is what we recommend. Because I think particularly around iSCSI, if you do have some kind of misconfiguration and there is some latency problem due to some routing issue or something like that, that can potentially help you there by not using those paths. And JOP, you've done a fair amount of testing there. So I'd love to hear from you on your opinion here.
Yeah, I did a lot of testing, actually weeks and weeks of testing on this, doing different scenarios. And I will say that yes, it works really well, especially with kind of cut and dry scenarios. So, you know, if you have paths that are 5 milliseconds versus others that are sub millisecond, it weeds those out very easily, very nice. If you have a path that is kind of hobbling along though, there still can be some challenges there that, you know, a common question we get is, hey, we had a single link that was kind of, you know, having a hard time processing IO, but the latency was still sub millisecond. And some people ask, well, how can that happen? Well,
so throughput's low, but latency remains consistent.
Exactly. And so in those scenarios, I still think that there's some work to be done. Now, will I say, overall, I feel like this is better than round robin? Absolutely, because round robin doesn't have the intelligence. And that's always been the problem with round robin, right? Is it's just kind of dumb. It fires and forgets down each path, however many IOPS you tell it to. So I love that VMware introduced this path selection policy, latency based. It's kind of least queue depth, you know, in other OSs with a little bit of a twist, because like Jason says, it takes into accountability load, but also latency. So I love the how they brought that together into that. Definitely much better performance, much better stability than the others.
Yeah, and more intelligence for sure.
Just kind of musing here, like I know that there have been some third-party PSPs that would try to like monitor the health of the fabric and intelligently direct that. But at what point, I feel like that might just be a simpler problem to solve long-term by just having the array inject latency into the path that it sees as bad, then try to do that as a custom PSP and tie that into, I don't know, there's this lot of complexity with this. And the challenge with the third party PSPs is I want to say third party VIBs don't currently work with VLCM. So now you're starting to limit other feature adoption. There's always something you need to be aware of, and you always need to be monitoring your fabric, I guess, as part of the lead of this. Make sure your syslog's configured on your fabric switches and things like that.
I mean, really, we want to try and get towards simplification, because like Cody, you mentioned earlier on, there's a lot of customers that they're not storage admins, they're not fabric admins, they're running the whole thing and they're powering in this new array and they really don't understand some of this detail. So having a claim rule that automatically sets the right PSP really helps the customer in simplification of setup.
Yeah. And I like this kind of actually falls back a little bit to my mindset around solutions is that like, so my team's job is to figure out how to get VMware feature or product X to work with Pure Storage feature or product Y. Right. And my first thing I look at is, do they work together out of the box? No. Okay. So then number one thing is, can we do something at Pure to make sure that they do? Do we need to add a feature, change something, behavior, whatever? That doesn't work. Can we work with VMware to change something? Can we improve their product? Right. Can we make something default, or can we make some kind of default rule or blah, blah, blah to make it work better? If neither of those things are possible, or maybe both, right? In the case of multipathing in Alua, right? So this one's active optimized, this one's standby. Oh, let's also get a default rule inside of VMware to make sure it's using the right one. But sometimes can't 100% do that. So that's when I look at, like, can we engineer a plugin? right? Can our best practice be use this plugin? That's when I go to that. And then the last one is like, well, we can't do that. Well, let's tell people how to do it, right? And the reason that I lean towards those first ones, even before creating a plugin or something, is that just like Jason mentioned, is that in these environments that are automated, right? Or, you know, like John said, like something requires a VIB, the more you have to install, the more you have to change, the harder it is to automate and support. And things like VCF, pushing down that route, like I wanted it to be very painless to introduce our storage into that. I want to be to limit the amount of changes as much as possible. And so that's kind of why we go that route. And we've been investigating heavily and seeing what we can do with this latency policy.
Well, that makes sense. Because if every vendor ends up adopting the best practice on round robin of adjust it from the default of 1,000 packets to one before it round robins, then it makes sense that we just try to work that upstream into being a default specifically on VCF and just kind of implement what ends up being the combination of vendor and VMware best practices that originally would have been like the VVD into one unified solution. We can all just move forward and everyone can quit having to worry about running CLI commands or even having to load plugins necessarily.
Certainly. Yeah. So Cody and J-Hob, I know you guys have been, Pure in general has been a really great vVols partner for VMware. You guys are supporting vVols with iSCSI. Do you also support Fiber Channel for that, or is that just iSCSI? It's both, yes, right?
Both, yep.
Yeah. And I know that has definitely simplified your vVols implementation using iSCSI. But you guys have also been working a lot with VMware Cloud Foundation. So I'm curious, when it comes to iSCSI, how does that fit into your VMware Cloud Foundation story?
Yeah, so I think it's, before I directly answer that, I think it's worth mentioning what storage means in a VCF world, right? So there's two types of storage, and I'll try not to use my hands too much because I'm probably listening to this, is that there's principal storage, and then there's supplemental. And sometimes there's been different names like primary and secondary, but it's, I believe, the correct parlance these days is principal and supplemental. Principal basically means when I'm deploying a new workload domain, which equals a new vCenter, a new cluster, et cetera. In SCDC Manager, which deploys this, I choose this storage option. Today, there are three options for principal storage. There's vSAN,
yep.
There is NFS, and there is VMFS on Fiber Channel. Supplemental storage means I've deployed a workload domain. I can go and add this storage to it, right? And so what is supported for that? Well, basically almost everything else, right? So vVols of any form, iSCSI or Fiber Channel, or VMFS via iSCSI. One of the reasons that I believe that iSCSI is not quite there yet as principal storage is because, you know, there's some networking questions. We're here discussing them right now. So these are things yeah. that need to be solved, right? Just figure out how can we do this and make it a supported like a fully supported option for automation across the board, right? And these are things that we're all working together to figure out the right way to do that. But it is fully supported as supplemental storage, right? So you deploy that first storage option, and then you can add that in. And so we're seeing a fair amount of interest. The iSCSI question is the most common one I get around VCF these days is, can I do it? Is it supported? What do I do? And we have a lot of tools on setting that up, vRealize Orchestrator, vSphere plugin, things like that. And I think there's some other cool options we can look into resolving because, you know, there are still some settings, iSCSI settings. And, you know, every time Jason and I do this core storage best practice session at VMworld, we've been doing it now for a couple of years and we're doing it again this year. We review all the vendors' best practices, right? We look across it because I'm not there necessarily representing Pure. I'm representing, you know, storage users with VMware. What are yeah. the best practices? And so we try to keep it, you know, vendor agnostic. I wear an orange shirt probably, but, you know, and so one of the things I look at is settings. And I think there are three common settings. And this comes up in VCF is like, do I set this? If I have another vendor, how does this affect it? And there's three that we see fairly frequently recommended around delayed ACK, around the iSCSI login timeout, and then also around the NOOP setting. And J-Hop, you can add a little bit of color on those settings.
Yeah, absolutely. So I'd say the first one and the biggest one is delayed ACK for sure. This is a common question that we get. Hey, what is it? Why can't I set it? And, you know, without going into a ton of detail here, the biggest impact you're going to feel can be from performance. And a lot of the times that's going to be from maybe a saturated network, or it could also be from some type of link connectivity problem, right? And so essentially what's happening is delayed ACK is exactly how it sounds. You delay acknowledgement. So typically in the TCP IP world, you're going to be delaying every packet. What delayed ACK allows you to do is you can respond to every other packet, essentially, or every X amount of packets. I don't remember off the top of my head what it is by default, but essentially you can delay that acknowledgement. And how that works is you receive the packets and it waits until the next packet is received to send that acknowledgement. So if you start to see slow or intermittent connectivity on your network, or some type of congestion or oversaturation, basically these acknowledgments can now cause you to be in a deadlock. You could be out of buffers on one side and out of buffers on the other. And one side needs the acknowledgement to be sent back, but it can't send the next packet because it's waiting for that acknowledgement. And so you get into that deadlock situation. And that is effectively why we recommend delayed ACK be disabled. We don't want to get locked in and set into those deadlock positions. We want the packets to continue to flow, and definitely helps in times of especially those scenarios. The next one is the iSCSI login timeout. This essentially has to do a lot with waiting for how long the initiator is going to wait for a login to be acknowledged. And the biggest reason why we say changes from 5 to 30 is particularly because of failover events. We want to make sure that those connections can stay connected throughout a failover event. Now, is it the end of the world if it's not set? No. A lot of the times, the iSCSI sessions will tear down. Controller comes back online and they'll be reestablished. So it's definitely not as critical as the delayed ACK. And Hostman, what was the last one you wanted me to talk on?
Our friend NOOP timeout.
Oh, the NOOP timeout. Yes, I wrote a nice long blog post on this. NOOP. So NOOP is effectively just it's an iSCSI ping, so to speak. And basically it just makes sure packets are continuing to flow. One of the challenges though is if this value is set too high, you can see a long delay in IO being transmitted, even if you have multiple paths. So if I have, let's say, four paths, and I pull path A, and I still have B, C, and D, well, you're going to notice that all IO actually comes to a stop. And it's going to come to a stop until that link is officially declared dead, and all of those IOs can be retried down a different path. One of those things that directly impacts that is this NOOP timeout. And what happens is if it's set to 15 seconds, well, you're going to wait 15 seconds until that link is officially declared dead because it didn't receive the timeout, because it didn't receive that request back. So it times out, tears down the path, and then IO begins to resume. So sometimes you can see upwards of 20 to 25 seconds because there's also retries that have to come into account. So what we recommend is lowering the NOOP value down to 5. And the reason why we do that is you're going to get a much cleaner, much faster recovery during link failures. And whereas instead of 20 to 30 seconds, you're going to see more to like 10 to 15, sometimes even a little bit less, depending on where it's at in that period. So that is the high level reasons for why we recommend those three.
I'd say that's a deep level reasons for probably a lot of people. But,
oh, sorry.
It's good. I asked you for a reason, right? But the reason I bring it up, right, because there's a lot of vendors that have different recommendations, right? Like we have 30, a lot have 60. It's all some number higher than the defaults. And there's a fair amount of these. And this is the reason, right, that from a VCF perspective, that iSCSI isn't principal yet, because there are some things to think about. And sure. So, Jason, I'd love to hear from you about what you've been talking about. Because I know you talk about iSCSI a lot, so I'm sure it's around VCF. What have you been seeing from the VMware side of this? We've got the storage side of the vendor side. So, curious about your opinion.
Right. So, for that exact reason, all of these different variables is why iSCSI is still in the works for VCF, right? It's not as straightforward as a basic FC environment where it's, hey, there are links there, just use it, right? It's port binding, it's NIC teaming, maybe, you know, and then to add even more complexity, if you've got an environment where you're doing routing, right now you're really getting to the point of, is it a common gateway? Is it a per kernel gateway, right? There's all these things that come into play. And so when you're talking about VCF, that's something that it takes a lot of intelligence to try and set up if there's all of these variables. Whereas if we could get to the point where it was, okay, here's a one or two supported methods, right? That might eliminate some of this logic that had to be built into the SDDC manager to try and figure out how to get your iSCSI connectivity correctly. Whereas, you know, supplemental storage, you're manually going in there and you're setting it up the way that either the vendor or VMware has recommended. And so that's kind of what we're seeing now. And that's why you haven't seen it come out as a supplemental storage right away.
Principal,
excuse me. That's correct.
Thank you. Yes. Clear this up, Jason.
Thank you. Yes.
So it's not principal, it's not supplemental. My goodness.
That's why you haven't seen it come up as principal.
Yeah, got it. Good stuff. All right. So listen, we're trying to keep it back to basics. I know this is a very technical topic and there's a lot of great information. There is no one best practice for for every environment. But yeah, as you mentioned, J-Hob has written some great KBs on this. Jason and Cody have both presented on this at VMworld and are going to continue to do that. Heck, I'm actually staring right now on storagehub.vmware.com, a best practices for iSCSI from Jason Massey. A lot of great content on there. I'm going to be adding that all to the show notes of the page. But one last question before we go. What do you guys think is the future for Ethernet storage? I mean, what do you think is going to be changing? I know there's a lot of conversation around NVMe. Is there do you guys have any thoughts around, you know, what direction Ethernet storage is going to go?
I have a lot, but I'll let someone else go because
I'm going to start. I'm going to start. There's too much overhead with this SCSI and all these newfangled things. We just need to go back to ATA. ATA over Ethernet is the future. It was the future back in 2003. It is the future now.
You heard it here.
That's right.
We can end the conversation. We're done.
John said it.
Custom ATA over Ethernet HBAs. That's what you'll be buying.
Yes, NVMe over Fabrics is phenomenal for a lot of reasons, right? But the main reason why it's so fantastic is like John said, there's a lot of overhead to SCSI, especially when you're using flash storage. And so NVMe was essentially built for flash, right? And much deeper queues, much better latency, parallelization. It's just overall, it's so much nicer. I'm a huge protocols nerd. I love when new protocols come out. I'm even going to a NVMe class in the end of August to dive more into it. So it's definitely going to bring a lot of benefits, and it's definitely the future. I think we still have a ways to go. There's still some things that need to happen before it becomes fully enterprise ready, but it's well on its way and definitely will be the future in my opinion.
Yeah, I try to give people a simple example sometimes of this. I basically say, like, you know, buying a flash array, and I mean like an all flash array, not necessarily pure storage flash array, but an all flash array without NVMe is kind of like having a 10,000 slot parking garage with one entrance. Right? It's like, yeah, you can get a lot of cars in there. It's great. But if you need to load it up, it's going to take a long time. And essentially what NVMe over Fabrics and NVMe does is allows every single one of those parking spots to have their own private entrance to that garage, right? And so that really opens up the concurrency that stops queuing up the stack and et cetera.
Well, actually, it's like worse than that. It's like having a parking garage that is one row. It's just one endless row. Like that's the serial nature of that single SCSI queue. That's a great analogy. I love how all storage comes back to car analogies here.
Yeah.
Highways, parking garages.
But yeah, I mean, you're talking about going from, you know, an average queue depth of 32 to 64, maybe 256 if you're lucky, upwards to millions now, like 6+ million. Like it's insane what you can reach. So,
well, and those parallel queues, like just being able to queue in parallel, so you're no longer paying. I know the sequential SQL latency isn't as bad on these modern flash systems, particularly if we're pulling out of a DRAM cache, but being able to have those cars, it's like having a multi-lane freeway. Like rather than just trying to get everyone to drive 160 miles an hour, we can have, you know, four people driving side by side, driving 40, and we get the same amount of work done.
I like it. Yep. I like it. Awesome. All right. Well, gents, we're a little over 30 here, so I like to keep them short and sweet. Lots of great information and lots of KBs and best practices on the show notes of this page. You mentioned that there is going to be a VMworld session, a best practices session with Cody and Jason. J-Hob, you got anything else coming on for yourself?
I do not. I'm just the man behind the curtains, just doing what the boss tells me to do.
And you do it well.
Thank you.
Good stuff. All right, John, we're going to let these gentlemen go. Anything else before we take off?
No, that's a lot. I need to now go review my own lab best practices and make sure that I'm not committing any war crimes of storage.
Are you going to pull out all your fiber channel and replace it with a iSCSI?
Token ring, man. FCOTR. Ring, yeah. It's the future. Get on the ring. Get on civilized the ring. Network. Civilized people.
All right. Well, that music tells me it's time to go. And so if you want to get in touch with us, send us an email at podcast@vmware.com. You can subscribe to us on your podcast app of choice by searching Virtually Speaking Podcast. You can catch this and all episodes at vspeakingpodcast.com. A big thanks to Jason, J-Hob, and Cody for talking some iSCSI with us. We're back next week, but until then, bye for now.
Enough of this jibber jabber.